Good morning, world. Welcome to another episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Albert Dicady and Emmanuel Coffey. Good morning, Counsel Coffey.
Good morning, Counsel. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Today we have a very exciting program. We will be joined by an esteemed attorney in the intellectual property world. His name is Mr. Claude Narcisse. So we'll get a chance to introduce him. Let me start with a disclaimer that everything that we say in this episode is our opinion and should not be is not imparting our employers. And also, we do not provide legal advice during this program. So, counsel, I do have a little bit of feedback.
Okay.
Yeah. So, today we wanted to start talking a little bit about our audience on, you know, what it is to actually work in the private sector as an attorney, and also looking at the side of working as an attorney for a company. And Mr. Narcisse has the experience as both been an in-house counsel and also been in the private sector. So he'll bridge that gap for us. And as we have fun doing our breakfast and hoping that everybody's having coffee.
Well, yes, we welcome everyone from wherever and at whatever time they may be listening to us. And again, we promise that you're going to have an exciting half an hour. So let's go at it.
Yeah, so... Mr. Narcisse, so the floor is yours. This is over breakfast, so we're having fun. It's nothing formal. Please let our audience know who is Claude Narcisse.
Fantastic. Hi, Albert and Emmanuel. Can you guys hear me okay?
You're coming loud and clear.
Loud and clear.
Very good. My name is Claude Narcisse. I'll say it in the English way of pronunciation. Not the nice way that Albert said, Claude Narcisse, which is how you say it in French. I'm very happy and honored that I've been invited by both Albert and Emmanuel to talk a little bit about my background. So let's dive into it. As Albert said, I have worked as an attorney specializing in patents for both the private sector, which essentially are law firms, and the corporate in the corporate world, where I've been associated with really one company, a major company. We'll get to the details a little bit later. I'm going to weave in my background a little bit with my experience, so we'll touch both. I graduated law school in 91. 1 year before my graduation, I worked in the summer for a firm, in what we call a boutique law firm in New York City. Those firms almost don't exist anymore, unfortunately. A boutique law firm is usually a relatively small firm, relatively speaking. 30, 40 attorneys that specialize in IP, and most of the IP or the most important IP would be patents, at least since I'm a registered patent attorney, at least I think so. But we used to call patents hard IP instead of soft IP, which are the trademarks and copyrights. Having spent the year there, when I graduated, I got an offer. I worked there, and my experience at that firm and other firms that I worked at subsequently were very similar in structure, meaning that you come in as an associate and you work for partners who want to work with you, who have worked for you, who like you, or for whatever reason, you get to work for them, and you get to learn how to relate to people of different personalities. But one of the things that I started doing immediately was patent litigation. I did quite a bit of that, not really understanding the entire process when I started, but I got used to it and grew to really like it as I went along in my career. The other branch of patent law that is, as patent attorneys would say, or would understand it, is patent prosecution. And that is the process of someone filing a patent and prosecuting the patent, which means getting the patent through the entire process according to the rules of the patent office, which can be, for lack of a better word, somewhat convoluted, and you really have to follow the rules and regulations. Otherwise, it's like stepping on one mine after another.
But Claude, yeah. Could you tell us briefly what your technical background is?
Sure. My technical background is I'm an electrical engineer. I have a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering. I worked as an engineer for about 7 years, mostly as a hardware designer of circuits related to communications and signal processing, whether it's communications or some other application. And I worked at three different companies before I decided to go to law school. So that's a very brief summary of my technical background. I also have a master's degree in computer science, and so I've done a lot of quite a bit of software programming in the applications realm, that is programming of signal processors and other electronic components that process signals instead of just a regular computer. So that's in essence my background.
That is awesome. Myself and Coffee, we spent a whole series. I think we did probably three episodes on processing patent application to the patent office.
Yes, I see.
It's always good to touch on it and always get a perspective of another attorney who worked in the field and have different experience. We did not mention it that it was stepping on different minds. I like actually like that that analogy very much. We always tell people that while going through the process, it's something that they can do on their own. But like anything else, the law is very it's you know, if you look at it from the beginning, you can say, well, okay, it's easy to get the patent, write a patent application, file it, and then go through the process. It's when you actually go in the process and you find that it is the getting to be very difficult, and when you get and that's when we always recommend that people do actually consult with somebody who knows what they're doing, either a patent agent or an attorney.
Right. And you mentioned patent agent. I would hope that some of our listeners understand the difference between a patent agent and a patent attorney. A patent agent is trained to understand the rules and regulations of the patent office. They simply don't have a law degree. So that's the difference. A patent attorney has the law degree and has a registration number, which is when they pass a test, the same exam that the attorneys take. If you pass the exam, you get a registration number. So one becomes a registered patent agent, and the attorney becomes a registered patent attorney.
Right, and I think that's also similar for our international audience, is that a lot of these jurisdictions, they have similar structure where you can either go to an attorney or one of these professionals who are registered with their local office or their country's office.
Right.
So if you're not sure which country you're in, we're referring this to the U.S., you can check on your patent office website and find out who are the professionals who could represent you in your prosecution.
Right. So far we've been talking about prosecution, and one main thing, my experience in the private, what we call the private world, private sector, which basically are patent firms again, or firms that have a intellectual property department where they provide services for patents. In firms, prosecution was somewhat looked upon by many firms as, well, you know, this is part of what our clients want us to help us on. But mainly, patent firms wanted to do things like patent trials, patent cases, litigation, licensing, well, not really licensing the deals, but more what we call opinion work.
Yeah, due diligence
work. Due diligence, that sort of thing. And it was really, to be honest, it was sort of a money thing, where they could charge a lot more money for those instead of writing a patent application, which is nothing to sneeze at. It's actually a very difficult process to write a patent application, and then also to prosecute the application through the patent office. So patent firms tended to they won't take patent application project, but they're looking in their eyes, they were looking to do the other things I just mentioned, patent litigation and due diligence and opinion work. My first job at this boutique firm in New York City, I did not do much prosecution at all. I was using a lot of the litigations to go do the technical analysis of whatever devices or systems we were looking at. But I did a little bit of the prosecution work, and I had a friend of mine who was working for a large corporation who had just left and went in-house for a large corporation. He told me I should check out this company because, you know, they need help with prosecution. And I told them I don't have any prosecution history. And that's when I decided to take the patent bar exam. So I get my registration number, and then I left. Not that much afterwards, I did work at this large multinational corporation. I don't know if you guys have any issues with mentioning names. I'm trying to avoid the name of the company, but
it's really up to you. I mean, the experience we need to know is really, and I think a lot of our listeners who are doing a startup, who are entrepreneurs, who are interested, and who may have ideas in brewing in their companies right now. And so as an in-house counsel, what would you recommend, go through that process? How did you, what policies you put in place? What did you tell your inventors? What should they look into to make sure that they capture all their intellectual property and follow through with them?
Right. So as in-house, if you are a company whose products are very technical in nature, it's an absolute must, it's a necessity to protect your work product in through the use of patents. I mean, if you don't have a patent, and if you have a very successful product or system, and you don't have a patent, people can start copying it, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that was at the top of the list as far as what we did in the corporate world, was to educate the engineers and scientists on how to have a mindset of always protecting the whatever it is they're working on, whatever project they're working on. And so what we did was design forms for every engineer, every technician, every scientist to document whatever it is they were working for. And we worked with the various business units and the head of the business units. So that whole approach was integrated into what an engineer does. Engineers were given notebooks. They were told to write things down, to save emails, just anything that had to do with the technical design analysis of whatever it is they're working for. It's hugely important. And I'd say on a much lower level, the startup company or the individual inventor should really follow the same approach. Document everything. Make sure it's documented in a way that it could be used as evidence if, God forbid, there's some type of litigation later on or some other process that attempts to prove or disprove the validity of the invention, or whether the invention was discovered or designed on at a certain date. All that becomes extremely important. Documentation, documentation, documentation is the big thing. And we developed form for them to describe their invention in a way that gets right to the point, because engineers tend to add a lot of details that are not really necessary for our purposes. And also, every month or every other month, I would go out to our different business units and give talks as to what a basic talks of what is a patent, what does it protect, what are your rights under patent. If you think somebody's copying your idea, what we say, infringing your patent, you should call us immediately. If you don't think that what you're working on is not that important, just make sure you document it, no matter how unimportant it may seem to you. And that last part is because companies generate patents, and this goes again for startup companies and smaller companies. They generate patents with an eye of not necessarily getting into that particular business that the invention belongs to. They may want to use those patents as to license other companies that are also startups who may want to buy that technology. And so they would enter into all kinds of licensing deals with other companies. So licensing of patents became a huge business for a lot of major corporations in the early to mid 90s. They became a separate business. They're just part of the business, the different business units that existed in the company. And I would say I know that the international property business at the company I worked at generated more revenue than a lot of the technical businesses that the company was selling equipment to. So patents became a huge business, and patents were sort of like it is intellectual property, but it is something that you can buy and sell and negotiate, and so it is a cheap way of getting revenues, because mainly is an engineer that comes up with an idea, gives us to one of us, we file for a patent, we get a patent, and then we try and go out and find people who would be interested in buying our patents or licensing our patents.
Yeah, Claude, so with the AIA, where the United States adopted the first to invent rather than the first to file rather than the first to invent, from what you just said in taking notes and speed of make taking notes and getting the patent out there, how does is that change? Is the instruction that you would give your attorneys before the AIA would be the same today, or has it changed?
I think it's always good to document what you're working on. The AIA, as you've explained, is whoever files first. If there's some kind of
Coffee.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I think we lost.
We lost Claude. It still says he's connected, but something happened.
Yes. I hope he doesn't even get a call. And he could, if he can hear us, you can disconnect and reconnect.
I'll do that.
Okay. You're here. We can hear you. Go ahead.
You can hear me now? No?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, so I'll stop. I won't disconnect. I'll just...
No, yes, okay. Continue.
So as I was saying, with the... it's always a good idea to document patents as early as possible, document the work that you're doing that eventually may become a patent application as early as possible for a lot of reasons. There may have been an engineer working at some idea, and then, you know, he's working on this project for a couple of years, and then he leaves the company. And he was like the really key guy. And, you know, if we don't have everything documented, it's difficult to go ahead and call this guy who's now working at another company to explain to us. Now, when companies hire engineers, they tell them to sign some kind of paperwork that says the invention belongs to the company, and that the engineer will cooperate as much as possible with the company to try and obtain a patent. And that involves, to a certain extent, even if the engineer happened to leave the company and is no longer working for the company at the time, the company wants to file for a patent. And there, the new employer of the engineer may have issues with talking to the engineer. So it doesn't hurt to document everything. And so I think that, not I think, I know that that approach is still followed by major corporations.
Yeah, that is a great example why you should continue to document. While you were talking, I was doing a little research on Kodak in particular, where Kodak was in bankruptcy and they were still able to sell their digital image patents to several companies for $525 million. So just to give, we always want to tease our audience on not just how important it is, but how valuable.
Patents are more valuable in a lot of ways than the actual products that are made, that are built based on the idea of the patents. Because sometimes you might build one version and there's another version of the patent. No one really thought of it, or at the time they thought, there's no market for that. And all of a sudden the market changes. So now the patent regains life. And, you know, I could give you examples also. I mean, way back, I'm kind of an older guy, but I remember Texas Instruments, which used to make signal processing chips and memory chips. I don't know if they've, I think they at one point stopped making stuff, or to a large extent stopped making devices, and basically lived on the revenues from licensing of their patents. So there are a lot of companies that attempt to use the patents as a revenue generator, because it's a lot easier, lot less costs involved. After all, it's a piece of paper. All you have to do is sit down and work out a deal with someone. Also, you can companies can go after people. I did what is called patent mining at the large companies, where companies just file patents. They believe in filing as many as they can afford. And so at some point, they have literally hundreds, if not thousands, of patents. I'm not exaggerating. And so...
Just to support that, the example that I gave you, when Kodak had a total of 1,100 patents they was able to sell.
And so those patents that they have, they have to figure out some way to make money out of them. And sometimes they will identify up-and-coming companies who have developed their own technology, but their technology happens to infringe on these patents. And so the company with a lot of patents would knock on the door and say, look, you guys are infringing. And we're prepared to work out a deal. If you don't work out a deal, you know, instead of the carrot, we have the stick. We'll take you to court. And patent cases are, if they're a legitimate patent case, they're very expensive. The legal bill is very, very high. I don't know of any other litigation except mergers and acquisitions where litigation is high. But I know in patent cases, you know, they would have a group of 10 lawyers on one case, you know, taking depositions at different cities at the same time. Another group, you know, doing motion practice with the case. And, you know, these are the lawyers who are charging, you know, very prime amount of money per hour. And it's a costly venture. And most people don't want to get into patent litigation. So
how important is incentive in-house for engineers or inventors to not only document but also create?
Well, if there was no incentive, the companies literally created one. They pay engineers. They would literally pay, look, if you file one of our invention disclosure forms, you fill it out. We have something called invention disclosure form, 9DS, and you fill it out, and then our attorneys file it and succeed in getting a patent. Once the patent issues, you get X number of dollars. And again, this is why I don't mention names. Where I was at the company I was in, there was this guy who was generating one idea every two or three days. The guy made a lot of money, and we were joking inside. We said he had enough money to pay off his mortgage, because he made a lot of money from filing patents. It was more of a mechanical guy, but his ideas spanned the gamut. They went to optical circuitry, telephone equipment. At one point, my boss called me and he asked me, is this guy legitimate? I said, yeah, and he's submitting stuff. They reviewed what he submitted. Everything was up above board. So there are various types of incentives that companies have to get engineers to follow their procedures to increase the patent's application submission process.
But Claude, time is really passing by fast when you're having fun, to say. But there is one point, though, I'd like to go back and see if you could touch on it before we close. It's this patent mining. And also, you're saying that a corporation may have a number of patents, and then another startup independently develop or come up with the same idea.
Right.
But how is that? I mean, I'm putting myself in the place of of one of our audience and asking, but I thought the examiner would do a search and things of that. But how is it that the startup happens to be infringing on that one?
Yeah, this is another example of why small startup companies must, in my opinion, must protect as much as possible their ideas through patents. I mean, I don't know of any other legal protection. The other protection is trade secret, which you can have a trade secret forever, but somebody can reverse engineer it and then you lose it. Patents don't work that way. So as we said before, patent companies have thousands and thousands of patents. They typically, in any patent portfolio, typically it's like 2 to 5% are really good patents. That's been the experience, and I have a lot of people I work with who will agree with me. So we try to go through the patents from different business units, and we identify those 2 to 3% of each business units, and then we try to identify companies where we think there might be a possibility of licensing. Now, the company may have innocently, without any information obtained from the corporation, developed a product that infringes on one of our patents. After all, you know, great minds think alike. It's just that our engineers thought of it first. So, and there's no issue of intent in patent litigation. You can't say, well, we didn't intend to copy, we just did it, develop it on our own. Intent is not even an issue. This is not criminal law, it's patent law. So if you happen to design something that somebody thought about, you know, before you, and filed and got a patent, you gotta talk to that guy. And so, companies take a license unless that device is not that important to them. But you know, you have to realize they spent hundreds of man hours designing the thing and then coming up with an initial design, and then they're about to scale it up to let's say they have some potential clients there. They're ready to really start selling the device, and then they get a knock on the door saying, you know, here's your device, here are the claims, and this is where you're infringing. And they, you know, you get something called a claim chart, and which is done by a professional patent attorney. And I've done many claim charts. My favorite thing to do, where you have a device, you take it apart, and then you look at what it does versus the claim language, a claim of a patent that was filed years before. And lo and behold, it's doing the same thing. So you have an infringement. And this is something, now, that will happen to a small startup, let's say. But this, again, the reason to file is huge, because that startup may have different versions of the invention. You both know that when you file a patent, it has what are called claims, and claims really define the meets and bounds of the invention. And so, but usually And if I have a client, I will tell them to file as many different versions of their idea as possible, which means when you, if you're lucky enough to get a patent, you should file a continuation and then just generate a family of patents. So you may be doing something in accordance with your first patent and that infringes, then you say, how about claim 7 of the second patent of the continuation? You might be able to get away with it. It depends on how the claim is written. Bottom line is, the more you cover your design with patent, the better chance you have of stepping onto a minefield without knowing.
So great. We, in every episode, we talk about the disparity that exists in intellectual property among minorities. And minorities, not just in the patent field, but also the gap that exists in minorities companies, and you know that we're not taking advantage of intellectual property as a whole. What step you think a country should take to actually bridge that gap?
Well, I think just first step is education. That's really what jumps into my mind. Most people don't know about patents. You know, people call me, they're like, hey man, I have a name of this company. I think it's a great name. I'd like to patent that. You know, they're talking about trademarks when then they say patents. People don't really understand what patents are. And I think it's part of the job of the USPTO have seminars, and I think they've started. At least the latest commissioner, who I like a lot, I think he started where, you know, they would invite people, especially small startup companies, to sit down in some of these seminars and just learn the basics. And because that's what we did in-house as attorneys. We go around giving talks to different people at different cities of the company to learn the basics. Of what a patent is, what rights does it give you, how do you get the right, and what you can do with the patent once you have it, everything. And I think part of the people not knowing is for them to be educated. It's not a very complicated thing, the concepts of the patent. Writing a patent is a whole nother thing. But, you know, it's education and learning the business of patents. There's a whole business of patents that's been going on for the last 10, 15, 20 years. You know, historically, if you look at it, patents were like totally unknown to people. Patents became very popular in the late 70s, early 80s, and 90s. But back in the 60s and 50s, you know, it was mostly large corporations or famous scientists who went for patents. The whole thing about a regular guy getting patents was unheard of. Well, I'm sure they were, but you know, patents now I think are known by small startups, but they're the ones who have taken time to educate themselves. People have the everyday guy out there who has an idea. I think should go and speak to a professional, either a patent agent or a patent attorney, and learn. And there's a lot of information on the internet, if you know where to go, that explains. But I think bottom line is, you know, we live in a society where there's a systemic problems for certain minority groups. And people may not have access to the internet to find out. There's a lot of information that's on the internet that can, if you're really serious about learning how to protect your idea, you'll find out, and basically you'll be able to contact an attorney, and hopefully you know, you'll be able to file for a patent application, which, by the way, is not cheap. You know, the fees and when what the attorney charges you depends on a lot of variables, but it's not, it's, it's something that's going to cost several thousand dollars, maybe over $10,000, depending. So I'm not trying to scare people. I think that there are ways you can, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you can still file for a patent application, but you have to really go out and educate yourself first about this. Educating yourself about getting a patent application is almost as important as designing whatever it is you're designing, you know?
I agree with you. I think where we start is bridge that education gap. And we've been sending people to, at least people in the U.S., we've been sending them to www.uspto.gov. That has a lot of information that will be a place to start. If you're in a different country, try to find your patent office. Most of them have websites with a lot of information that you can start learning. And, you know, if you're interested, you know, you have to do your due diligence. Claude said it's not cheap, but I will add that the rewards can be significant, you know, it is a topic worth learning, and I know time is doing us an injustice here, and we're gonna have to leave this topic the way it is today, and we want to thank Claude for joining us today. This was an awesome episode. I think people will find a lot of information in it. Again, I'm Albert DeCady. I can be connected with on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at ADCCHY.
Yes, and my Twitter handle is at Coffee Law. And it was awesome. It was a great, great episode. We thank Claude for being one of our guests. Hopefully, he'll be back again. And until we see you next time, be well.
Okay, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and bye-bye.